I'm Celia, and I'm here with another Young Scientist Spotlight, where we meet the rising stars behind some of the coolest science out there. Today, I am super excited to introduce you to Dr. Catherine Hatcher. She's a neuroendocrinologist and postdoc studying how the brain controls hormone release and reproduction. Spoiler alert, your brain and your body are in fact connected, and they talk to each other a lot. Catherine also talks about finding a self-care routine, taking the big leap from grad school to postdoc research in the middle of a global pandemic, and how sometimes the perfect mentor was waiting for you at the top of an escalator all along. I absolutely adore her, and I know that you will too. Enjoy.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Catherine. If you want full name, I'm Catherine Hatcher.
Dr. Catherine Hatcher.
Oh, yeah, I keep forgetting that. Hi, I'm Dr. Catherine Hatcher. I don't go by doctor normally, so it is very weird to say. But I am a postdoc researcher now at Albany Medical College. I study brains and things and hormones and stuff like that. Yeah.
We love to see it. You, like, literally just started your postdoc, right?
Yeah, this was my fourth week this last week. So I am, like, fresh. I am, like, a little postdoc fetus just exposed into the world. It's very painful sometimes.
Yeah, I was going to ask what that transition has been like, going from grad school to moving across the country and starting a postdoc. Walk me through that journey.
Most folks know that once you finish grad school, regardless of what your degree is, it's exhausting. I thought I was going to celebrate a bunch when I finished, and I ended up sleeping like that whole weekend. Regardless of when you finish, pandemic or not, it's exhausting. And then I had 2 weeks to kind of wrap things up. I didn't have a lot of revisions, so it was pretty quick to kind of turn my dissertation around. But I had like two weeks to wrap things up and then basically just pack up my life with my partner and move. Nobody really tells you how much money it costs to move if you want to pay somebody to do it for you. It would be like almost like 10 grand to move like all of your things. And we all know being a grad student doesn't pay well enough. And being a postdoc is shamefully not well being paid well enough. And so, you know, it just turned out to be more economically friendly to do everything almost by ourselves, except with Dominic's family's help.
Well, you made it.
We made it. So yeah, so then basically I had 2 weeks until moving. And then once we got here, I had another 2 weeks until I started. And so because of COVID and everything, we were able to basically unpack our apartment within like not even a week. It took only a couple of days like to unpack the whole thing because we had nowhere else to go except the grocery store and like Target. So we couldn't really do anything, so we unpacked. And then once I started, it was like the first week I was like jokingly posting on Twitter like day one, like watched a bunch of videos, and day two, watched some more videos. And then like by that Friday, it was just 0 to 60, like just craziness. Going into the postdoc transition can be tough. Most of the time it's hard. Like, I went from a lot of behavioral neuroscience to more like transgenic mouse models and these other, you know, techniques that are very different than what I was doing. So like in order to get caught up to speed to even begin a project, let alone like just be somewhat competent in the lab, it's been a lot of like observing and training and things like that that have just been going like crazy. Adding on the layer of, oh, most labs were shut down for 4 months.
Right.
And have just now started like up and running again. You know, there's a lot of like sense of urgency to like get the work done. But we all have to also learn how to do the techniques. And my advisor is newer, like literally new. She started her lab like last fall, which got the rodents up and running, you know, our mouse colony up and running. And then all of a sudden it was COVID. So like she is like ready to move. And it's great for training because it's like I'm learning so much all the time. But I'm like, what is sleep and socializing? But I can't socialize because it's a pandemic. But like I need social time. So it's this weird like mass ball of craziness of being exhausted, but also like really excited about everything that I'm doing.
Well, I think there is a lot of mystique surrounding the transition into postdochood. And it sounds like you really switched, not like in fields entirely, like you're still doing neuroendocrinology related things, but you're totally learning all of these new techniques. Are people expected to already know how to do the things that they're going to do in their postdocs, or is it pretty normal to have to like switch and learn a bunch of new stuff on the job?
That's a great question. And I really think that I hate this, but it depends. And I think when you're interviewing for your postdoc, I think that's an important question to ask. How will I be trained on things I don't know how to do? Not only is it like, will you also be trained on things that you already know how to do? Like, for example, being a neuroscientist, it is my job to take brains out of mice skulls pretty regularly. And I have done a lot of that in my career. I've done a lot of it in my master's, a lot of it in my PhD, done it with mice and rats. And it's like, I get to this lab and I'm still being shown how to take out brains, not condescendingly, but because of the way that they do it is still very different than the like seven ways that I've learned to do it before. Your big question was like whether or not people are expected to know how to do things before they come in. And so I guess the answer is probably not as much as we think we are. Having just gotten a PhD, which is like, oh, the highest degree that you can get in your field, I feel like I should know how to do everything. And why?
Right.
Why? Like, I'm an expert in the thing that I studied, but that doesn't mean I'm an expert in all of neuroscience. By no means. That's like impossible. And so like, I've been having this internal dialogue and struggle of being like, you know, Catherine, you should know how to do this already. We get that habit. I don't know if that starts in grad school or before grad school, but I feel like that habit starts to pick up the more senior you get. And it's like, no, if you're literally learning something like as of 30 minutes ago, and I would always tell my students this too, if you're literally just learning something, you shouldn't expect yourself to be perfect at it right away. But I feel like as a postdoc or, you know, a more senior person, regardless of your degree, you are going to feel like, oh, I should know how to do something, like immediately. Trying to remind myself, no, that's not the case, Catherine. You can learn things and go a little slow. I think an important aspect of going to graduate school and like completing your degree and showing even that you've done this handful or hand set of techniques that when you then go to train to do your postdoc, you are marketing yourself as somebody who's trainable. So even if you do have to learn stuff, you can be like, hey, I may not know how to do that thing, but I'm really eager to learn how to do it because I know it's an important technique in the field. And hey, look, I've learned all these other techniques, so I most likely will be able to learn this thing too. Don't let anybody ever try to tell you that postdocs need to know how to do everything right away. I needed to hear that, I think, a couple weeks ago.
It's just so funny to me that it's like, oh, you thought that maybe getting a terminal degree in your field would fix your imposter syndrome? Like, think again. It in fact just unlocks a new level of imposter syndrome.
Because now you're like, I have a PhD. Especially as a postdoc, but depending on your program, potentially as a graduate student too, it's easy to get stuck in a silo and forget that you are surrounded, maybe not in person, but virtually by hundreds and thousands of like academics or graduate students or professors or postdocs or whatever. They're out there. There are people out there who are literally going through what you are going through, and you just have to find them and talk to them and be like, hey, I'm feeling this thing. And they're going to be like, oh yeah, I was there like 3 days ago, totally felt that thing. So this is why I think like building a network of people at whatever stage along, you know, your trajectory that you're interested in, but then also building a network of people within your current stage is super, super critical, because that's how you find out like, oh yeah, this thing that I'm feeling may be kind of normalized in academia, but doesn't mean that it's okay, first of all. And second of all, it doesn't mean I'm alone. Like, I'm not alone feeling this way. Even just a couple of days ago, in the throes of my mini emotional breakdown after a long day in the lab, I just threw out a tweet. You never know when a tweet is going to actually get attention or not. But I was like, hey, I'm realizing I just need some postdoc friends. Like, let's be friends if you want to be friends. And then it, you know, got probably like 100 comments at this point of people like, be my friend. Like, postdocs are lonely. We need friends. So I think going to the virtual world is a very easy and really safe way to find people who are just looking for somebody else to connect to in a similar stage of their career. But you might even find people with similar research interests and similar backgrounds and things like that.
It is very comforting to know that you can just throw a request for friends out into the ether and like 100+ people respond wanting to be your friend. That is so heartwarming and really just tickles my soul to know.
It's precious. But I think it does highlight how lonely postdocs often feel. Postdocs are so like, work, 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 or at least, you know, we have that stigma that that's how we're supposed to be, that, you know, I feel weird trying to wiggle my way into some postdoc's life who's been here and established for a couple of years and be like, hey, I'm new and I just got here, but let's be friends. Like, making friends as an adult is weird. It's weird and sticky and gross.
It's so weird and gross. Now that we're talking about postdoc stuff, like, what is it exactly that you are doing in your postdoc? What are you studying?
I work with Dr. Shannon Stevens. She is really interested in how the brain is involved in regulating fertility and reproduction. Her big science love is really understanding puberty and how puberty works. What is the brain doing? Now, everybody who thinks of reproduction in the brain, those of us who even think about it, we're like, the hypothalamus is where it's at. But come to find out, the hypothalamus is not just where it's at.
Scandalous.
Ooh. There are other brain areas that are likely talking to the hypothalamus and being like, yo, something else is happening that you need to be concerned about. So in particular, my advisor is really interested in studying the role of the medial amygdala and how it's involved in regulating reproduction. So there's these cool little neurons that were traditionally studied in the hypothalamus called Kisspeptin neurons. So there are these neurons expressing the gene KIS1. And KIS1 encodes a functional neuropeptide called Kisspeptin. And Kisspeptin is like, hey, hormones in the brain that regulate reproduction, do your thing. And so then those hormones talk to the pituitary. Pituitary talks to the gonads. Estrogens, testosterone are made in the gonads, and reproduction is working on its merry way. So Kisspeptin is like the very high upstream regulator of the reproductive axis. And Kisspeptin traditionally has been studied in the hypothalamus, but we're finding Kisspeptin neurons exist outside of the hypothalamus, which means that they could potentially be talking to the Kisspeptin neurons in the hypothalamus, but nobody really knows. So we are basically looking at those extra hypothalamic Kisspeptin neurons and seeing what they do. What happens if we excite them, turn them off, get rid of them, manipulate them in some way? What happens to reproduction? What happens to hormone production? What happens if we like inject some fancy tracer virus and look at how those Kisspeptin neurons in medial amygdala, how are they connected to other brain areas? Do they actually connect directly to the hypothalamus? Our big question is really trying to figure out, what are these neurons in the medial amygdala doing specifically in the context of reproduction?
So I have several stupid questions relating to this. The first stupid question is, what exactly is the hypothalamus?
Yeah. So the hypothalamus is this nugget of a brain area that just sits kind of at the bottom of your brain. So if you were to take your brain and think of it as kind of a ovally shaped ball, it would be like in the center of the ball on the bottom. It hangs out down there and does all sorts of things. People like to think of the four Fs: fighting, fleeing, or fornicating, if this is PG. What's the other one? Feeding. Almost forgot the four F. So fighting, fleeing, fornicating, or feeding. So the hypothalamus does all sorts of stuff, like regulating when are you hungry or not hungry, when are you thirsty or not thirsty, does your blood pressure go up and down, what's your body temperature, like really basic bodily functions are regulated through the hypothalamus. So one of those is hormone production. And there's all sorts of hormones that are regulated from the hypothalamus. in the context of reproduction, or hormones like gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH for short, that is the one that tells your pituitary to tell your ovaries or your testes or whatever gonads you have to make hormones like estradiol or testosterone. The pituitary, which is connected to the hypothalamus, it's like, in pictures, it really does look like a little ball sack that's just hanging from your brain.
Adorable.
The pituitary is a little gland that hangs off of your hypothalamus and also is involved in regulating hormone production and release. So the hypothalamus and pituitary are often thought of working together to do a lot of important endocrine functions. Hypothalamus is like part of that lizard brain, that quote unquote, that a lot of people like to reference in popular culture, because it really is highly conserved across species. It might look slightly different, but it's like you could talk about hypothalamus regulating reproduction in fish, and it's going to be relatively similar to when you're talking about it in rodents, and it's going to be relatively similar when you're talking about it in like primates and humans and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that's extra cool, because I bet that that relieves a lot of the angst that one might feel about doing research in rodents, where you're like, oh, does any of this actually matter when I'm a human and I'm self-centered and I only care about myself? And it sounds like the answer is yes. Like, this is similar enough in rodents that you can translate those things across species.
Yeah. The organization is slightly different, yeah. But it's like, and what it does is highly conserved across species.
And the amygdala does at least a couple of those Fs also, right? I think of the amygdala as like something to do with fear.
Yep.
Is that because it's related to the hypothalamus in some tangential way, or are they kind of like separate entities?
I think they are separate entities, but it's likely more connection than we currently know. I think they've traditionally been studied very separately, but the more and more we study them together, we're going to see that they probably are like talking back and forth and really integrating information in a way to tell maybe the cortex to go do something related to fear or related to feeding or whatever. So they're really going to be probably working together to drive these bigger behaviors.
Okay, kisspeptin neurons. Do they relate to something that we know about in humans that makes them particularly interesting? If they're broken, does something horrible happen in our brains that we pay attention to? Or, like, why are they interesting?
If you start to mess with kisspeptin neurons and make them not functional anymore, you can't make babies. And all sorts of things go wrong. If you disrupt kisspeptin neurons enough and kisspeptin signaling, you end up with basically tiny little gonads that are non-functional. Like, they're there, but they're not really doing anything. So it's really answering kind of the broader question of getting into fertility and how can we really understand what mechanisms are controlling fertility and understanding it as much as we possibly can to potentially treat different disorders that might specifically affect fertility, if that makes sense.
That does make sense.
So looking at kind of the central component, the nervous system component of fertility-related disorders, all levels of the reproductive system will help us understand maybe why these disorders are happening and or how to potentially treat them.
Speaking of this being cool and something that you find cool, what brought you here to this postdoc?
That's a great question. I think it actually starts with my first year of grad school. I was brought into the lab to potentially do circadian rhythms research, and I started getting involved in research relating to endocrine disrupting chemicals. So that was kind of one thing. The other thing was I wrote this NSFGFRP, which is it's a fellowship program for graduate students or like senior undergrads and early graduate students to pay for themselves. My PhD advisor's research before I joined the lab was really understanding the role of estradiol. She was interested in understanding how estradiol is involved in regulating circadian rhythms. Specifically, she was interested in things like animals' sleep-wake behavior, when they get up to start running at night, and when they go to sleep during the day. She had done a lot of really cool work of like taking out the ovaries or taking out the testes and giving animals estrogens back in the form of these tiny little capsules. And she did all of this really cool work to characterize how hormones are regulating circadian rhythms. But she needed, like, the next step was kind of looking at this more mechanistic approach. And so I wrote this really ambitious, with my current skill set at the time, fellowship to basically inject this type of enzyme that would basically cut away these different genes within the specific brain area that we were interested in. It got immediately rejected for so many reasons. So there was kind of this seed planted that you can do this. You can inject things into the brain, and not just drugs, but you can inject like enzymes or viruses into the brain to help look at stuff or knock things out or excite things. And so this idea kind of was planted in my brain. Never got funded, never did really any circadian rhythms research related to that at all during my whole PhD, because that's how money goes, you know, in science. And then I ended up doing more endocrine disrupting chemical research. So I started to learn about environmental chemicals that disrupt our endocrine system. That was like a completely new area of research for me. In that time, I started to work really closely with a lab that studied the role of environmental chemicals and how they affect fertility. And so I started to gain interest in the reproductive system, had this interest in hormones, had this interest in circadian rhythms, had this interest in like injecting things into brains, as I like to tell my friends and family. So when I started looking for postdocs, I was like, if this is the direction that I may want to go in the future, you know, all of these interests started piling up in my brain. I want to find somebody who does something in this general area that will give me the skill set I would need to then start my lab in the future. So in comes Shannon, who does the injecting things into brains. So the scientific word you might look for is stereotaxic surgery, or you're using this really fancy machine that has like coordinates and this is and that's, can pinpoint this exact place in the brain, and it sticks like a big needle into the brain and injects stuff, and it's really bonkers. Cannot believe it exists. And she does that. She injects the viruses into brains. She knocks things out. She makes things excited. Like, she does all these things. And she has this reproduction component, which was like, yes. It had a lot to do with kisspeptin, because kisspeptin is really cool, and it's part of the reproductive axis. But a lot of it had to do with, like, big overarching concepts and big overarching techniques that I could learn as a neuroscientist, and specifically in this field, that I could then make myself marketable for grants and faculty positions and things like that in the future. Especially if you're wanting to get into research within academia, you have to really think like 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the line, what kind of research do I think I want to be doing that I might generally be interested in? What are those gaps in my current training that I need to fill? That's what my postdoc should be filling as much as possible. I put out this tweet on Twitter. Twitter is like my science love. It is the best networking tool that exists. But I put out this tweet like, hey, it was basically an advertisement for myself to be like, I am looking for a postdoc to start next summer. Somebody was like, hey, there's this new faculty that studies neuroendocrinology. You should look her up. I looked her up and I was like, oh, I'm really familiar with her postdoc PI's research. I've read her papers before. Like, I know who she is. Cool. At SFN last fall, back when you could go to conferences, RIP, I had literally just arrived. So this was the one in Chicago. Literally just arrived with my advisor, was standing, ran into two people I knew at the top of the little escalators at McCormick Place. You know, we're at a conference with what, like 30,000 people? I don't know how many people.
Like so many, so many.
It's huge. Within like 5 minutes of arriving, up comes the escalator, comes Shannon. And I was like, shut up. Like,
that's like a rom-com. That just is it was implausibly adorable.
It really was a meet cute. So we exchanged numbers and then we eventually chatted. And then I came and interviewed in person in January in upstate New York, which is very cold. And and it was just like, you know, it was the sequence of events that kind of just fell into place. But I really think the big part of it was that, like, my advisor could connect me to some people, but, like, if you feel like your advisor is not connecting you to the right people for your postdoc, like, go out and, you know, strut your stuff on social media or whatever you need to do.
Just to, like, stand at the top of conference elevators and wait for advisors to escalate themselves towards you.
Oh, my God. It's like, oh. It's finding something that kind of feels natural and comfortable to you, is in within your research interests and is within your kind of the trajectory that you're wanting to go. Like, postdocs are hard. You might as well make it as enjoyable as possible.
Are there general topics that are particularly sexy these days in neuroendocrinology? Like, what are neuroendocrinologists getting pumped about right now? I guess another potential avenue for answering this is, like, what do you think should be hot?
Oh, yes. What do I think should be hot? I really think, oh God, I love this question. I think, you know, coming from my baby neuroendocrinologist pedestal that I'm standing on, or my little soapbox, neuroendocrinology and endocrinology in general is such an integrative field. And you cannot study one hormone or one hormone system without studying another. And what I mean by that is, like, as somebody who studies reproduction, I cannot study reproduction without thinking about stress. Like, I can't do it. If I do it, I'm completely ignoring something that may significantly impact my results and make my results non-reproducible, which in science is, like, a really huge problem. And if my results are non-reproducible, like, what's the point? Why did I do that work to begin with? I cannot study reproduction without thinking about food and food intake and body weight and things like that. Like, reproduction is one of those things that is so sensitive to what's going on within the body and the body systems, like what's happening with the stress system, what's happening with food regulation and like insulin levels and things like that. Like, those things also influence reproduction. And it goes, I think, the other direction as well. I'm not as familiar with the other direction, but like, you couldn't study food regulation without thinking about stress either. I mean, stress affects everything, we know. But, like, you really have to think of neuroendocrinology especially, but even endocrinology in general, as, like, an extremely integrated field. And I think that that's the direction that science needs to go in. Now, does that mean I need to be somebody who's an expert in, like, 70 different lines of, you know, hormone systems? No, by no means. But that means I should be collaborating with somebody who's a stress physiologist, or collaborating with somebody who does study food regulation and insulin and diabetes and things like that. I should be collaborating with people and doing really collaborative science, writing those big fancy grants that, like, get tons of money because you're integrating all of these ideas. Like, that's the direction that neuroendocrinology needs to move in, because you can't be an expert in 17 different things. Like, it's not going to happen. You can be an expert in your area and know generally what's going on outside of you, and then bringing those people in. And, like, I'm kind of thinking of, like, a little, you know, circle that we're building together. But it's like, yeah, bring your little integrative science circle together. And I think that's what's going to move the field forward. And I think neuroscience in general. Like, we all know you can't just study one tiny little piece of neuroscience anymore, like, because all of that's been taken up. We have to now start thinking of the field as more integrated. So come on, neuroendocrinologists, let's do this. Let's talk about all the things going on in the brain and hormones. And I think too, like, I would be remiss to mention, like, immunology is something that I think is going to be really sexy in the neuroendocrinology field in the coming years, like those hot glia and astrocytes and all of those fancy little doodads. Those guys are going to become huge. And I already know of a few functions that they have in relation to the neuroendocrinology of reproduction. And so it's there. Like, if you think of a random aspect of neuroscience that could potentially be related to your field, it probably is. And also, I'm going to throw a little bit of shade at some neuroscientists or general biologists. The brain does not act on its own. The body does not act on its own. We got to think of them as talking back and forth. You may not study it, but at least think about it. And then here's another bit of shade to throw, coming from my circadian biologist pedestal. And then I'll be done throwing shade, I promise. You got to think of time of day. At least look at the literature and see if somebody's looked at circadian rhythms. 9 times out of 10, you will probably find that there's a circadian rhythm to take into account. So,
drop mic.
I'm just saying.
And now I'm just like, oh no. Like, I bet that the time of day does affect how I think, which I should know because I'm a person who exists.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, probably has a preferred time of day when you feel the most productive or more impulsive in your decision-making when you're hungry. Like, wow, all of that stuff probably matters a whole lot.
Oh, it doesn't probably. It really does a lot. I'm dying over here. And, like, if your cortex is the one that's doing the decision-making, but your cortex relies on your deeper brain areas to do its job, and those ones are the ones that are like, oh, my God, I'm hungry, or, oh, my God, I'm thirsty, or, oh, my God, I'm tired, or, oh, my God, like, I need to make babies, or something is going on down there deep in the brain that is not getting taken care of, that cortex is not going to be doing its best job. So this is where self-care comes in. Take care of yourself. Fill your cup first.
Oh, wow. I love it. And also, what a perfect segue into...
Oh, God. I didn't even mean that.
asking you about exactly this. Because I know that in addition to being a, you know, baby postdoc extraordinaire, you also have done a decent amount of stuff online. For a while, you were running the Instagram account Grad Self Care, talking about all of these things. And you also have your own podcast, which I have listened to. It's very good.
Real quick, I forgot to mention it at the time, but Catherine's very fun, very nerdy podcast is called Endocrine Disruptors. You can find it on endocrinepod.com or wherever you're listening to us right now. I will also list it in the show notes for you on carrytheoneradio.com. So you can click on that and learn all about hormones and those parts of the brain that are like, oh my God, I need to make babies. Okay, back to the interview.
I would love for you to talk a little bit about mental health and why you care about it and things that you think people should know.
I am somebody who has had some sort of battle with mental health since a pretty young age. I think officially my first diagnosis of like depression came at around 13 or 14 or so. But I would argue that it probably happened earlier because I was one of those kids that would like cry and talk about how I felt like I had something missing, like something was missing or I had a hole in my heart. And I think that that was my way of explaining depression as a kid. And you don't know what depression is, so you don't know what you're feeling. And so as somebody who has dealt with depression and probably an anxiety disorder that was undiagnosed until my 20s, you know, I have this like special connection with maintaining your mental health and like really feeling like I was at my best when my mental health was in check. I really feel like you cannot show up every day at any level of your career and do your best unless you are doing everything you absolutely can to take care of yourself. Now, I want to start this conversation also with the caveat that, like, there are a lot of issues with academia that significantly impact people's mental health. And, like, it is not your job to A, fix those things, nor B, like, it is not necessarily, like, possible for one individual to fix these things. But, like, if you are having mental health struggles in graduate school or at any aspect of your career in academia, it's not your fault. And it's not your fault if you're having mental health struggles anyways, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. Because there are a lot of issues within academia that we could talk about that really contribute to mental health. That's not what we're talking about here, though, for this particular conversation. Because as somebody who did see those issues within academia and get really frustrated with like the lack of response, I was like, there has to be something I can do to take matters back into my own hands to some degree. And a lot of that is recognizing like, oh shit, like I don't take care of myself properly. And like, it really is as little, you know, little things for me, at least to start, to be like, oh, like, I'm not feeding myself well enough, or truly, like, I'm not drinking enough water or not getting enough sleep. Like, it's really easy as a graduate student to get so wrapped up in your work that you forget to take care of yourself. And in a culture where we're constantly being told to produce, like at the drop of a hat, it's really easy to forget to take care of yourself. I reached this point in my graduate career was like, okay, Catherine, like you've been talking to a therapist for a while, you're on meds, like you are slowly realizing like it's time to take care of yourself a little bit. part of that was like, my therapist was like, you need to get a hobby. My dietitian was like, you need to get a hobby. My parents were like, you need to get a hobby. Because literally all I was doing was like going to work, coming home, watching Netflix. I'd argue that Netflix can be a hobby. Eating a bunch of food and maybe socializing occasionally. And like, those things are fine, but that can't be, for me at least, that could not be my only like outlet. I needed to do other things. So my first hobby was reading. Like, I picked up reading for leisure again in my late 20s. And I read like, I think like 10 or 15 books that first year that I started reading again. And it was like, oh, a little hobby really went a long way. I started sleeping better because I had more of a nightly routine. Like, little things like that started to make me feel like just an increment better. And then I was like, okay, let's start talking about this on social media, because I am somebody who likes to talk too much and sometimes forget to listen. And so I made an Instagram account called Grad Self Care. So I made this little account that I was like, okay, I'm going to talk about like self-care strategies that are getting me through like just being a graduate student. I'm 3 years in. I'm miserable. Like, let's talk about it. And I don't want to say it blew up and I'm like, look at me. I'm like Oprah with 500 million followers or whatever she has. Probably a billion. I'm probably, God, Oprah, I'm sorry. You probably have so many more than I just said. But, cause, you know, she's listening.
I'm sure Oprah's going to be very personally offended by your miscount of her Instagram followers.
So offended. But, like, you know, it did blow up more than I thought it would. And it really grew into this just big conversation about being a graduate student in academia. But, like, how am I taking care of myself? But I think a part of this that really connected with people, and I'm not tooting my own horn, it's just, this is what most people, this is when I got the most feedback, was like when I would talk about the shitty stuff going on, or when I would talk about like, this is what I'm experiencing that's negative that nobody ever talks about, or very few people talk about. What did my day look like today because I had a panic attack 5 minutes into my teaching? Like, what happened today? I got a paper rejected. Like, what did my day look like? This is how I felt. This is what I'm going through. Like, who else is going through this? Or who else, like, how did you get through this? Having conversations like that about the really sticky and gross stuff that nobody really wants to talk about, or only get talked about within circles that don't then make it out into the broader world for other people who may not be having those conversations. You know, they're not hearing those things. I think that's what resonated with a lot of people the most. Now, everybody has a different experience in graduate school, but a lot of the central themes were kind of consistent across the board. We know like 60 or some really high percentage of graduate students have, or at least we're estimating around 60 or so percentage of graduate students are having some sort of depression or anxiety episode. Like, we should be talking about this more. And so it kind of blossomed from those ideas of like talking about my experience, talking about how I'm trying to counteract it. Because like at the end of the day with mental illness, you have to really just focus on what you can control. Yes, there are these really bad things that happen in academia that we need to address, but we have to start focusing first on ourselves and what we can control before we can really be our best and then turn around and be like, okay, this stuff is BS and we need to talk about it and change it. So by all means, like, yes, there are a lot of things that are wrong in academia, that eating your protein and getting 7 hours of sleep at night or 8 hours of sleep at night and drinking your water and doing your yoga, like, those things are not going to heal academia, but they're going to heal at least parts of you that you can then go and fight what you need to fight.
Yeah, it's really just that same idea, again, that your brain does not exist in isolation from the rest of you. You need to take care of the rest of you to make sure that your brain works, and then you can use that brain to fix the horribly broken systems within which your brain and your body are forced to exist.
Yep, exactly.
Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to, either this year or in the relatively near future, given that 2020 is,
dumpster fire?
It is what it is.
So, most immediate future, I'll say one thing, is I get to cut some balls out of mice next week.
You can just pretend that each one of them is Elon Musk and then be like, yeah. That's what I would do.
But, God, that probably sounds terrible to somebody who does not study rodent castrations. But it is a very, very safe and protected and, oh, God, that was probably terrible to say.
It is a scientific procedure, not just a hobby.
God, I'm fearful of my new advisor, like, hearing this and be like, oh my God, who did I hire?
I hired a sociopath, like, the only reason that she wants to work here. Cut some balls off of some mice.
But I am really excited about it because it's, like, reaching the next stage in my training, and it's not truly the cutting balls out of mice that I'm excited about. It's the, like, surgical procedure and everything, learning how to do an important step of our research. So we take the gonads out of mice, so either testes or ovaries, in order to remove circulating hormones, and then do, like, we can manipulate the hormones in another way. So I'm excited about that. Another thing I'm excited about, my partner just got a job. Hopefully he still has that job when this airs. And that also means that we can slowly but surely start saving for our wedding, which is hopefully going to happen next fall, assuming
a lot of things.
Oh, so many things. But yes, so I think that's an exciting little personal thing that's happening for us, that we've been kind of anxious to even begin wedding planning, partially because of, you know, him moving across the country with me without a job was very scary. And now that we don't hopefully have to worry about that, we can actually start thinking of our wedding, which is really exciting.
That's so nice. Oh, like, I'm like, oh, remember normal things, like going to weddings? Must be nice. Well, I hope for yours, and I mean truly everyone's sake, that our government gets its act together by next fall. Like, one would hope that in 14 months from now, I shouldn't even say anything. I feel like I'm gonna jinx it.
Yeah, I remember being excited that a conference was canceled in March because I really didn't want to go to a conference at that time because I was working on writing my dissertation. I was excited about the conference being canceled, not excited about COVID and coronavirus, or the SARS-CoV-2 spreading, but I was excited about the conference being canceled. And here we are.
Yeah.
5 months later, and I'm, like, wanting to go back to early March Catherine and, like, kick her in the shins and be like, see what you did? What you were excited about? Here is what you were excited about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really none of us could have guessed that the month of March was going to be 5 months long. And it's great. Yeah, I mean, what a delight you are.
Aw, thanks. You're awesome, too.
This made me really happy. A very good start to my Saturday, for sure.
And your start of a new month, which, even though time is elusive, it is still start of a new month, if you care about those things.
At this point, I don't anymore. No. Like, this, I don't need landmarks to tell me about the passage of time. I can really just revert to my lizard brain circadian biology and just be like, is it light or is it dark? Am I hungry or am I not? That is the only thing that matters in these times.
Honestly, it really does. Like, you are not wrong. Listen to your body. It knows what it's doing sometimes. Not all of the time, but sometimes. If something feels wrong, it probably is. Otherwise, keep going. Keep listening.
This episode was produced by me, Celia Ford, with help from the team at Carry the One Radio. This episode was supported by the Office of University Development and Alumni Relations at UCSF. An extra big shout out to all of our Patreon supporters, including Colombo Ahmed, David Cabral, Janine Cuevas, Levi Kai, and Stephanie Redmond. If you have some spare cash floating around due to, you know, both the indoors and the outdoors being canceled this fall, I can think of one place to send a few bucks. Patreon.com/carrytheone. Your donations help make our science communication possible, and we really, really appreciate your contributions. Something else we always appreciate that costs $0 is comments and reviews. Let us know what you think. And for more CTOR, check out the rest of our episodes on carrytheoneradio.com or on whatever app you're using to listen to us right now. Thank you, and as always, stay healthy, stay sane, and stay curious.